It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This week at the Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland, acclaimed author Amy Tan spoke as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures Literary Evenings. Since the success of her first novel, The Joy Luck Club, Amy Tan has been telling the stories of Chinese and Chinese-American women, particularly mothers and daughters, in her new novel, The Valley of Amazement, released earlier this month. The story is set in the early part of the 20th century and told from the point of view of a part American girl named Violet, whose mother, Lulu, runs what is known as a first-class courtesan house called Hidden Jade Path. Violet is raised among the courtesans of Shanghai in the early part of the 20th century. Amy Tan is here in Studio A to talk about the book and her illustrious writing career. Amy Tan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be here.
I understand that you were in the process of writing a different story when you came across a photograph that connected you to your grandmother, and suddenly your plans changed. What can you tell us about the photograph?
It was a book about Shanghai. The photo showed 10 women, and 5 of them were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing in my favorite photo of her that sits on my desk and serves as my inspiration. These women were courtesans, the 10 beauties of Shanghai, 1910, 1911, and that's exactly when my grandmother's photo was taken.
So what did the clothes look like? Describe what these women were wearing.
They were wearing a headband that formed a V at the top of their head with pearls, embroidery. They had a very tight jacket on with the collar that went up to just below the earlobes. The sleeves were tight and stopped just below the elbow, and there was white lining, matching braces, tight pants, and it was taken in what was known as a Western photo studio with a painted backdrop and also with pots of flowers around. That all of those details were specific to courtesans, I found as I read more in that book. The one detail that the academics I consulted with told me was the most telling was the photo studio. And they said no woman went there except courtesans. It was as if that place was there only for courtesans. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm thinking of all the reasons why she might have been wearing this outfit and why she went to the photo studio. And I thought of myself, you know, maybe I inherited her love of costumes and, you know, I play in a band and I wear a costume. You know, maybe she did something similar. But it just kept coming back to this possibility. She had been a courtesan.
So at this point, it might be a good idea to explain what exactly a courtesan is for anybody that doesn't understand.
I don't think we have a concept that's similar anymore. Courtesans were actually courted. They were in these very lavish places. The houses and the courtesans of that time had Western furnishings. The courtesans, in fact, popularized Western culture in Shanghai. They innovated fashion. They, you know, ate American food, Western pastimes such as pool and billiards. They also were the ones who chose which men were going to receive their intimate favors behind the doors of the boudoir. They were also typically very young. They started their career at about 14 or 15. They were done. They were washed up by the time they were 21 or 22. And they had better have had something lined up before that happened. Otherwise, it would be a progression to a second-class courtesan house or to a flower opium house or the streets or something worse.
So not in a situation where you were able to choose, where you were...
You would try to campaign to become the concubine of one of your patrons. And that would be probably the best situation you could have. If you were extremely talented, you might be able to make a go at it as an entertainer. Very rarely would you become the first wife to a, you know, any kind of man of substance.
What did you figure out or come to learn about how your grandmother might have fit into this context?
You know, I'll never really know for sure unless her ghost was standing here saying, yes, it's true. I spent a lot of time reading much more about courtesans, and I talked to relatives, and I saw the contradictions in the stories. I was told that she was an old-fashioned, traditional woman, very quiet, a stay-at-home kind of mom. And then somebody told me, oh, she was known for having a fiery temper and that she had very strong opinions, and if you didn't listen to her, you were, quote, sorry later. The other people said she was the fourth wife, but she was the favorite, which was rather unusual. The other wives in the family were younger. They were 16. The other story that was told is that she was raped by this rich man and forced to become his wife. I examined the story again in light of what was said, and I thought, there's something very puzzling. The story was that the man came into her room when she visited with her half-sister. The half-sister got up, the rich man took her place and held a knife to her throat and said, if you don't marry me, I'll kill you. And another story was, he held the knife to his throat and said, if you don't marry me, I'll kill myself. Now, I started realizing the knife is the red herring. Something just doesn't fit. Why would he, need to say he's going to kill her? He was the patron of the island. He built all the schools, the roads, the hospitals, the water system. He was the hero. Why would he murder a woman and, be thrown in jail? He had any woman he wanted. So who knows what the real story is. I don't know if it was love or they needed to have a story because she was a widow, and to find some way of making it seem acceptable.
And did you ever come to find out what happened to her, what became of her?
She killed herself. She had a son, and this was the other thing that was rather striking. She made him make a promise that if she delivered a son, it would be his first son, and in that case, he would buy her a house in Shanghai so she didn't have to live on this island where she had been taken. And I read later that is what courtesans made their patrons promise, that if they became their concubines, that they would buy a place for them in Shanghai. Well, he reneged on his promise. And I don't know if she asked him soon after or if it was that she was nagging to him for a while, but a month after the baby was born on the New Year, she killed herself. She took an overdose of opium. It may have been accidental. The family made a big point of it that she really did intend to do it because she ate sticky rice cakes, and that meant that it wouldn't have been able to come up as though the rice would stick to the innards and not be able to, be expelled somehow. But all these things, this emphasis on the knife and the rice cakes, and I started looking at it and saying, why were these points made? And it could be that it truly was that way. But there are little details that contradict what the former story was.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is author Amy Tan, whose new novel is The Valley of Amazement. So as you are processing all of this, Amy, and considering what the photograph means, how did this end up morphing into the story that you tell in The Valley of Amazement?
Well, I was so obsessed with the idea that she had been a courtesan that I started researching everything I could find and everything on Shanghai of that period. And I decided, listen, I'm so deeply entrenched in this, I might as well just be there. I just want to be in Shanghai 1910 and figure out what life was like there. But more than that, my books have always been about self-identity, how we become who we are. Or how I became who I am. People think it's mothers and daughters, and that certainly is part of it. One of the greatest influences on me, and I think on many women, is their, you know, it's their mothers. The mothers have much to do with shaping them, shaping their rebelliousness, and also those traits that they have later in life that they swore they wouldn't have, they find they have them anyway. So I thought about how we were born into certain families. We have a birthright of some kind, and that all of this changes over time depending on what has happened to us. You know, whether it's war or hardship or trauma or the loss of a parent, the loss of somebody in the family, marrying somebody who turns out to be the wrong person, you know, being betrayed, going to school or falling out of school, all of those influences, how do we change at every turn? How do we not, I mean, what do we not change? What would we never change? How does it affect our notions of hope, trust, love? And that really is what the story is about. It is about abandonment in one sense, and that is a theme that runs in our family. My mother abandoned her three daughters in China and went to the United States. Her mother, my grandmother, abandoned my mother by killing herself. My mother was nine and wanted to go with her mother. She didn't understand where her mother went. So this story has some of that in it as well.
Did writing this book help provide insights into your relationship with your mother? Because I was reading that your relationship with your mother was sometimes quite rocky.
It was quite rocky when I was a teenager. And I think we got along better when I was in my 20s, but that was because I avoided topics. I avoided seeing her, bringing up anything that she would get upset about. So we weren't really able to talk. But at the same time, we were conspirators. We were our own little group of people isolated from the rest of the world when my father and brother died. No one else understood what that felt like and what that meant. My little brother, my mother, and I, we were like a cult of three, always thinking we're all going to die. It was a very strange time, and I tried to break away from that as well, you know, both adhering to one another and then trying to break out of it.
And you ended up defying her as a young adult. She wanted you to study medicine, and you wanted to be a writer.
Both my parents thought I should become a doctor. Here I had this chance. Some psychologist, when I was 6 years old, gave me an IQ test and said, she has what it takes to become a doctor. And verbal areas, no, not so much. You know, I would excel in math and all these hard sciences, but not the writing. And that proved throughout the years, whenever I took these aptitude tests, that was the case. It was always good in math, not so great in verbal areas. But when I got to college, I said, I love to read. You know, I'm going to change from pre-med to English major. And that's what I did.
And she didn't like that.
No, she was very disappointed. But I think I did it also because my father had died and I couldn't disappoint him. And I was a daddy's girl, and that was the person I would most have feared disappointing. And my mother, I just knew she would be angry. But she was, you know, and according to everything that ever happened in our lives, she would be disappointed with anything I did as far as I was concerned. I had that viewpoint when I was younger, and it changed. I look back now over time, and I think we had a closeness that through fighting, in a way, you have a closeness about many things that people don't have when they don't talk about it. She was a woman of very deep feelings, and I realized that's what I do in my writing, that my meaning in life is to think as deeply and to feel as deeply as I can. And writing pushes me toward that. You know, you read a story, you read fiction as you're writing it. You just say, oh, this is not reaching far enough. This is too easy. And you have to keep pushing yourself. That's something I learned from my mother, that she was a very deep feeler. She was a little too deep at times, you know, really intense, but a little too intense for survival. She was suicidal at the same time. She threatened that quite often. That's something I'm glad I did not inherit from my mother.
You ended up taking her on a trip. You would take your mother to China to see the daughter or one of them that had been left behind almost 40 years before. Describe what that was like and the impact it had on you.
She had actually gone to China before that. She left in 49. She went back in 79. She hadn't seen them in 30 years. And she told me that she didn't recognize them, of course, because they were, to her mind, old ladies. I went in 1987 for the first time, and I took her with me. It was a promise I made to myself when I thought she was having a heart attack. And I went to the phone and I said, oh, I don't know anything about her. Who was she? I said, if she lives, I'm going to listen from now on to all those horrible stories she has been trying to tell me. And I'm going to take her to China and meet these daughters of hers.
Who were you saying that to besides yourself?
I said, dear God or Buddha or whoever is listening. It was a moment of existential crisis because a lot of who my mother was, at that moment I said, a lot of who she is who I am. And if I don't know who she was, there's going to be a big piece missing out of my understanding of myself. So I also realized, you know, there was something that we hadn't talked about, you know, this love that we had and the worry she'd always had and that I should appreciate it. So I took her to China and I had a lot of myths blown. You know, I thought she always got into arguments with people because they didn't understand her English. But she had more arguments in China. You know, I ended up thinking that English had held her back. And she was still in China warning me, here I am, an adult, you know, be careful, you know, or don't buy that. You paid too much money for it, you know. It was driving me crazy. I had to sleep in the same bed with her 24/7. And it was really difficult, but I knew it was the best thing I could ever do. And I came home and I started writing Joy Luck Club. I came home, actually. Suddenly there was an offer for this book I had not written except for three stories. So it was like a magic time.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is author Amy Tan, whose new novel is The Valley of Amazement. And you were talking about the Joy Luck Club just before that was published and became this huge success. You were a business writer.
Yes.
How did you go from that to writing fiction?
I was a freelance business writer, and somehow I fell into this subject of telecommunications, which was really expanding at that time because AT&T had broken up and everybody was vying for this piece of the pie. And I ended up getting a lot of clients. So I was very successful, had clients who loved me. And everybody would say, well, this is an ideal freelance career, but I was very unhappy. None of this was meaningful to me. I was very good at it. And I thought to myself, what's going to finally satisfy me? And I went to see a psychiatrist, and he was very helpful. He fell asleep three times. And that made me decide I should take care of my own need to find satisfaction in my life. And I started writing. I said, okay, I've always loved to read. And I used to write great letters to friends. People love those letters. And I would take jazz piano, improvisational jazz, and I would start writing fiction, and I'd see which one of them stuck. And guess which one stuck? I started reading books people recommended, writing short stories. I went to my first writer's workshop where I met Richard Ford, who, you know, was been a friend ever since. But I knew that's what I wanted to do from that one writer's workshop. My story was torn to bits, but it didn't feel bad at all. Because people were talking about what's the voice of the story, because the voice determines what story can be told. I thought, wow, this is interesting. And I decided I had to be serious about this fiction writing. I would continue with my work as a freelance business writer, but I would make time for writing fiction. Instead of working 90 billable hours a week, I would work only 50, and I would use the, quote, leftover time to write fiction. So I did that for, as much as I could. And every time I kind of forgot about writing the fiction, some strange thing would happen. You know, somebody would say, oh, you know that story you showed me? Well, I slipped it over to the editor of a little magazine, and they want to publish it. And I would get all excited. You know, it was a circulation of 300 newsprint kind of thing, $30. But it was a reminder to keep doing this. So that was my early writing.
So then the Joy Luck Club becomes this huge success, and then it's made into a movie.
That time was very difficult for me because I never expected to get published. I had made myself a reasonable goal to take fiction writing seriously by saying I would be published in a good little magazine, good literary magazine, by the time I was 70. And the little magazines that I had in mind were things like Grand Street, Tri-Quarterly, Paris Review. So when this happened, it was like winning the lottery without having ever bought a lottery ticket. I didn't trust it. I didn't know what was happening. I was happy before that, basically happy before that, except for my, you know, working too many hours at something that was not as meaningful to me. But I was happy with my marriage. We owned a home, getting along with my mom. And I thought, this is going to change everything. This is going to mess things up because it's so seductive. And people were changing toward me. And, you know, friends treated me suddenly a little differently. And it was frightening. I had to write something down to myself and say this is what's important because I don't want to get lost. I don't want to lose my moorings as to what's important. And I think it's very easy for people to do that. Sudden success, and it can go to your head.
So how did you manage to maintain an even keel after all this?
Well, I broke three teeth, molars, grinding my teeth at night. You know, it's hard to say, you know, if there's any way to stay even keeled about it. I had to remind myself the most important thing was family and to understand the reasons why I write, not to please people, but to really use it to discover something about myself.
Amy Tan's new novel is The Valley of Amazement, released earlier this month. She's in Pittsburgh as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures series and joined us in Studio A. Amy Tan, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And more Essential Pittsburgh to come on 90.5 WESA.